Before AI can help your business predict demand, accelerate growth, inform decisions, automate tasks, reveal insights, generate content, you have to trust it. Introducing WatsonX Governance, helping you govern any AI as data, models, and policies change so you can scale it responsibly. Let's create AI that begins with trust with WatsonX Governance. Learn more at ibm.com/governance. IBM, let's create.
What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casuals and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
So, should we go electric?
I think we should go electrified with Toyota.
Electrified?
Electrified means options. Yes, we could go all electric with a Toyota bZ4X, but then there are hybrids like Grand Highlander, or we could do something in between like a RAV4 plug-in hybrid.
So, Toyota is electrified diversified?
Yep, and with more options for reducing carbon emissions, the closer we all get to Toyota's Beyond Zero vision for the future.
Exactly how much coffee have you had this morning?
Learn more about our Beyond Zero vision for the future at toyota.com/beyondzero.
Hello, and welcome back to Movie Mike's Movie Podcast. I am fired up today. I saw the first look of Hugh Jackman returning as Wolverine in Deadpool 3, and I didn't like it. So I want to share with you what I think are good suits. Not only good suits, but the best suits of all time. I have my top 10 best superhero suits in movies. In the movie review, we'll be talking about Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning Part 1. You got Tom Cruise flying around doing his own stunts. Did it live up to my expectations? Which, quite frankly, pretty low. Not the biggest fan of Mission Impossible, but this one had my attention. And in the trailer park, we'll be talking about Wonka. One of my favorite movies of all time is getting a prequel. And by the first looks of it, I don't hate it. So thank you for being here. Shout out to the Monday Morning Movie crew. And now, let's talk movies.
In a world where everyone and their mother has a podcast, one man stands to infiltrate the ears of listeners like never before in a movie podcast. A man with so much movie knowledge, he's basically like a walking IMDb with glasses. From the Nashville Podcast Network, this is Movie Mike's Movie Podcast.
Let's get into the inspiration behind this episode. So a photo was posted last week. It's Hugh Jackman returning as Wolverine in Deadpool 3, which is coming out next year, and this is the first look we have at the suit. When this movie was first announced that he would be returning as the character, my immediate reaction was, we are finally going to get the comic book accurate Wolverine suit. You know the one. It's yellow and blue. It's sleeveless. It has his muscles ripping out. It also has the iconic pointy helmet and then the weird boots with the pointy tips and all the things that make it look so iconic. And it's a look I greatly associate with the time I got into X-Men, the cartoon from the 90s. And it's the version we never got in the movies. And quite frankly, the original suits in all the X-Men movies were pretty terrible. They were so leather heavy, and I think the reason is because in the early 2000s, Marvel was not what it was today. It was really trying to establish itself in the real world. Therefore, when you deal with realism, you can't really throw a bunch of actors into spandex. People wouldn't really take it seriously. So I think for that reason, the costumes in those X-Men movies really suffered because it really wasn't what comic book fans wanted. But that and Sam Raimi's Spider-Man allowed it to break into the mainstream, and we all got comfortable with the idea of a superhero suit. And now, in the 2020s, it is much more just acceptable to do a very comic book accurate suit that can be a little bit more cartoony, a little bit more fun, because really that's what we all have been itching for. So after seeing this first look of Hugh Jackman in this suit, I didn't like it. I don't think it looks as comic accurate as everybody is saying. I think it's a really hard thing to do because, again, I am associating it with the Wolverine cartoon from that early series and also the comic books, and everybody's saying it looks exactly like it. I don't really see it. Maybe in the little details on the side as far as the Wolverine marks. But to me, it just looks like he is in a motorcycle racing suit. It looks like he's about to hop onto a bike, not about to kick someone's butt. And also, the colors are a little bit off. Yes, it is completely yellow, which is cool to see him in, that they finally committed to that. but it's not blue and yellow. It's blue and black. So he kind of looks like a bumblebee. And I've seen different versions of this picture taken off the internet. And some people have changed the colors themselves. But in the original photo that was posted, it looks black and yellow, black and yellow, black and yellow. And I think it's bad because I don't immediately look at this suit and think Wolverine. But to the left of him, you have Deadpool. And I think that is really why the design is the way it is, because it looks more of a reflection of the world that Deadpool lives in, which is much more of a tactical suit, has kind of these same panels. But that is really what that Deadpool suit is in the comic books, and he has one of the best comic book accurate suits. So I feel like they had the same approach with Wolverine, and it just doesn't look the same. So yes, I wanted him to be in yellow spandex, much like they made the joke back in X-Men in 2002 when Cyclops jokingly tells him, "What, would you prefer to wear yellow spandex?" "Yes, I would." So I don't see those same comic book accurate details, especially with the boots. He is straight up just wearing motocross boots in this suit. It looks nothing like the ones from the comics or the cartoon. So I am not nerding out over this costume, but I don't think it'll affect my feeling going into this movie, because up until this point, the Deadpool movies have not let me down. So I also don't know how often this suit is going to be used in the entire movie. It's just a picture. It's worth 1,000 words. We don't know if this is just one gag scene where maybe Deadpool was telling him, "Hey, why don't you get in the yellow suit for old time's sake?" And they have this one little montage of him in the yellow suit. So I am not fully believing anything until we get that first trailer and see what he's actually going to look like in the movie. Maybe once it's on screen, it looks better. But right now, I am not a fan. So instead of talking an entire episode about bad suits, which is an entirely different episode that I'll do in the future, I want to talk about my top 10 best superhero suits of all time. The only rules for this episode is it must be in a movie on the big screen adaptation, and I am not including villains into this, and I'm also not including suits that are entirely CGI. So the Hulk isn't really a suit, it's an entire person, so he will not be on my list. So let's get into the list. At number 10, I have Patty Jenkins' Wonder Woman from 2017. The reason I love this suit is because it is the right amount of comic book accurate, and also the right amount of a tactical suit that actually has the functionality. And the Wonder Woman suit is one that would be so easy to make it cheesy and make it not look good on screen. And this suit is also the right amount of sexy, because when they made the first suit worn by Linda Carter, that version was actually based on lingerie. However, Gal Gadot's suit was actually based on Roman armor, and that is the feeling you get in this movie. She looks awesome, but she also looks like she can pummel your face in. And I love every time this suit is on screen. From the very first moment I saw her in the suit, I knew they had cast Wonder Woman perfectly. And most times, I don't feel that way. I always feel like, you should have cast this person, should have cast that person. But Gal Gadot is the perfect casting. You have the strapless red-plated armor, the blue skirt, the gold headpiece, and the armor on the hands and the arms. It's all just worked together perfectly. I think I just love the color palette too, of the red, blue, and the gold. So at number 10, I have Wonder Woman suit from 2017. At number 9, I have Christopher Nolan's The Dark Knight, the bat suit worn by Christian Bale in 2008. And this suit was so highly influential on every comic book movie adaptation that would come after it. And when you look historically at the Batman suit, it was always one of the most comic book accurate suits. But the problem with that is it wasn't as practical to the actor playing Batman. Because if you remember in the early iterations of the suit, there was always a problem with Batman turning his head. He couldn't swivel his neck. He'd have to turn his entire body. And sometimes that looks very awkward on camera. But the reason for that is because in the comic books, the entire thing is just connected. What Christopher Nolan's Batman suit first did in Batman Begins and then greatly improved on that in The Dark Knight was fixing that problem with some upgrades, making it look more like it was a suit designed by the military. It looked like it could take a bullet, unlike the rubber suit in the late 80s and early 90s. I even loved it, even though there was less emphasis on the Batman logo in the center. I also just love the spikes pointing out of the sleeves. This suit just worked on so many levels, and I feel like so many superhero movies took inspiration from this suit and how tactical it could be, especially with the iteration we had in 2022 with the Batman, which is much more of a ragged Batman suit. That suit could not have existed if it wasn't for Christopher Nolan's. So at number 9, I have the Dark Knight suit from 2008. At number 8, I have Tim Miller's Deadpool costume from 2016 worn by Ryan Reynolds. And this is a big upgrade from the one we got in X-Men Origins Wolverine that looked terrible. His mouth was sewn shut and it looked nothing like the comic books. And the Deadpool suit is just so incredibly faithful to the source material. It essentially looks like Deadpool just leapt off of a comic book page right onto the big screen. You add some texture to it, and that is what you get in the first Deadpool movie. So I think if Deadpool was one of my more favorite superheroes, this one maybe would have ranked higher. There's just something about it when it's on screen, maybe it's all the red, that just immediately makes your eyes go and stay there. I also love that the white eyes allow Ryan Reynolds' character and his voice acting to really shine because they are so expressive on this suit and such a big part of it since it doesn't have a mouth. So I feel that part of this suit allows it to be much more animated and larger than life. So that is just a great detail combined with the rugged belt, the swords on the back, and the fact that he is always holding two guns. So this suit looks awesome, and it is the perfect look for an R-rated movie. And even though it is so comic book accurate, there's still a sense of realism to it, and I think that's why it's worked so well. And I'm glad they haven't really changed it a whole lot in what we're seeing from Deadpool 3. So at number 8, from 2016, I'm going with Deadpool. Moving on to number 7, I have the Russo Brothers Captain America suit from Civil War in 2016 worn by Chris Evans. Now, what you had with the early Captain America suits was a much more comic book accurate suit with the red, white, and blue and the helmet. But what I loved about Captain America more than any other superhero suit is its evolution over time. It went from a much more cartoony look to a very much more rugged and more defined, subdued look over every single appearance in every single movie. And the reason I love that so much with Captain America is it greatly reflects the character development of Steve Rogers. Because his character was so bright-eyed and bushy-tailed in the first movie, and then over time with every single battle, he became very much more weighed down with life and all the things he has been through, all the things he felt like he missed out on. And his costume reflected that in every single iteration. But where I loved it the most was in Civil War, because you still had the red, white, and blue. But the red was almost a blood red that was a lot more subtle. Same with the white. It wasn't really off-white. It was just a very dirty white that almost had like this spray-painted black over it. You still had the classic helmet with the A, but everything was just kind of worn looking. So this felt like the suit that was a reflection of the transition of his character, and it was just a little bit different than it was in Age of Ultron. So at number 7, I have Captain America's suit from Civil War. At number 6, I have the OG, Sam Raimi's Spider-Man suit worn by Tobey Maguire in 2002. I don't think I appreciated this suit as much as I do now until No Way Home, because now I feel that this suit is so classic looking. And I was saying earlier when talking about X-Men that these suits needed to look very realistic. They needed to look less cartoony to be able to break into the mainstream. And I almost feel that Spider-Man in 2002 was kind of the in-between of both of those ideas. You wanted to make a Spider-Man suit that comic book fans would love, but also one that would just look good on screen and not just feel like a live-action cartoon. And what I love about Sam Raimi's Spider-Man is all the shots when it's actually placed into a real-world situation. So it's Spider-Man on the street after his first save in the movie. I remember the first time I saw that, and I was like, wow, Spider-Man actually exists like this in our real world. They finally did it. I love the raised web detailing. I think that is kind of the main staple of this costume that gives it this almost 3D look throughout the suit. So it very much looks like the classic Spider-Man look without feeling cheesy in any way. So out of the three major on-screen portrayals of this suit, this is the most classic. This is the OG. This is the one at number six, Sam Raimi's Spider-Man suit from 2002. Getting into the top five now. At number five, I have Tim Burton's Batman Returns, the bat suit from 1992, worn by Michael Keaton. Now, this one is really just an improvement on the 1989 suit, which you may say is the more iconic one. It is really the one that was more used in the Flash movie we had earlier this year. But I felt like the 1992 suit was an improvement. If you put them side by side, they are very similar. The improvements I'm talking about are the ones related to the armor. In the 1989 version, especially with the abs, it looks just like Batman has some ripped up abs. They improved on that in the 1992 version, and it looks more like he is wearing armor, which I think is a much more sleeker look. And I think all around, the 1992 version just looks so much better on camera. But my favorite detail about this suit that I wished another Batman suit would incorporate is the iconic logo with the yellow background. That is a symbol I look at and think Batman. And maybe it's not the most practical of suits. What I was saying earlier is a big setback to this suit is the fact that you have to turn your entire body to turn your head. It looks a little bit awkward, but I'll give that up for it looking so comic book accurate. You have the colors, you have the tactical belt, you have the best ears. All the gizmos and gadgets and that gold belt are perfect. So at number five, I have Tim Burton's Batman Returns Batsuit. Moving on to number four, I have Zack Snyder's Man of Steel, the Superman suit worn by Henry Cavill in 2013. Now, don't get me wrong. The 1978 Christopher Reeve costume is iconic, but it's incredibly cheesy. Sometimes too comic book accurate can be cheesy. That's okay. What this suit did was take inspiration from that suit, but greatly improve on it. And what I love about the Man of Steel suit is it looks much more like something an alien would wear, which that is what Clark Kent is. That is what Superman is. He is an alien from another planet who comes to Earth. This is more accurate of what he would wear. He wouldn't just be wearing very bright blue and red spandex with a big S on it with a yellow background. He would be wearing something more like this, very skin tight, kind of scaly looking with a more subdued blue and red. But my favorite detail about this suit is the logo. Instead of being an S that means Superman, it's a Kryptonian symbol. And the S is actually the symbol for hope. So it's a lot fatter. It kind of looks like a snake in a way, maybe an anaconda. And I think that is the detail that really sets this suit apart. I mean, also the fact that Henry Cavill has the body of a god. And when he puts this suit on, he looks like a force to be reckoned with. And it's my favorite cape suit. In my top three, there won't be any superhero suits with cape suits. But the best superhero to wear a cape, because he's one who actually needs it, is Superman. He flies. He needs a cape. And I think a great superhero suit should be inspirational to not only adults like me who are nerds and do podcasts, but to kids. And I think the Superman suit is inspirational. I could imagine a kid even now stumbling upon 2013's Man of Steel and thinking, I want to be Superman for Halloween. That is the sign of a great costume. So because the design stays true to its core, it has that familiarity, but it also just feels much more majestic. That is why I put it at number four, Zack Snyder's Man of Steel, the Superman suit worn by Henry Cavill. Moving into the top three, at number three, I have Jon Favreau's Iron Man 2. It is the Mark IV suit worn by the one and only Tony Stark, played by Robert Downey Jr. in 2012. So a brief history on the Iron Man suit as far as the movies. The Mark I was the one he made in the cave. The Mark II was the first one he made after escaping the cave. It was essentially the prototype Iron Man suit, but it was the one that was entirely silver. And then the Mark III was the one in the 2008 Iron Man. And that was the suit that very much paid homage to the comic books. To me, it looked a little bit more softer and rounded edges. So I felt like the Mark IV in Iron Man 2 was such an improvement on it. And I think it is the perfect suit because it keeps that iconic red and gold color scheme, but has a bit of a sleeker design. It's a lot more streamlined. there's a lot more detail in the chest and the rib cage and the ab area. And the helmet just looks so much better, a little bit less cartoony. And this is even though I love the Iron Man movie way more. I rewatched Iron Man 2 recently and feel like it's a little bit forgettable, but I could not stop looking at how good the suit looked. I also love this one because it still has the circular core in the middle before they started messing around with that and it turned into a triangle, sometimes went back to a circle. But this one just overall had the right amount of everything, the right amount of red and gold, the right amount of functionality, and overall is my favorite Iron Man suit, and that is why I put it at number 3, Jon Favreau's Iron Man suit from Iron Man 2. At number 2, I have Ryan Coogler's Black Panther from 2018. It is the Black Panther suit worn by Chadwick Boseman. And the first time we had a look at this on the big screen was his first appearance in Civil War, which was a great suit. And I felt like his suit was such a breath of fresh air at Marvel at the time because everybody was just starting to look the same. We had been with these characters for so long, and you throw Black Panther on the big screen, and it looks so different than every other suit. So every time he was on screen in Civil War, I just wanted more. And that is exactly what I got in the Black Panther movie. The suit also requires a large amount of special effects to make it look believable. And they did an incredible job doing that, bringing vibranium to life. It appears almost lightweight and skin tight, but also looks extremely durable and looks like it could take the beating that it does every time T'Challa gets into a fight. So you have this basically entirely black full body suit with these metallic materials all throughout it, paired with the feline details, the ears on the mask, the clawed gloves. All of it just works together and looks like it's made for a king. It's made to look exactly like what he is. He is a king who is also a soldier. And I also love that much of the costume design is an homage to different African tribes. The Black Panther suit is actually in the National Museum of African American History and Culture. So the fact that the suit also honors history and the way that the suit complements T'Challa's wardrobe when he is not wearing the Black Panther suit, just what he wears in normal everyday life throughout the movie, that is something that no other superhero really has. Because even when he's not wearing the suit, you know that T'Challa is Black Panther. And it's also my favorite suit that works well without a helmet. I think my favorite scenes are where it's just T'Challa wearing the suit without a helmet. Maybe it's because I get to see Chadwick Boseman's face and that just makes me happy. So at number 2, I have Ryan Coogler's Black Panther suit worn by Chadwick Boseman. But at number 1, my favorite superhero suit of all time is Mark Webb's Amazing Spider-Man suit from 2012 worn by Andrew Garfield. And I know this Spider-Man suit isn't for everybody, but I feel like it was made just for me. Because like I was saying earlier, the Tobey Maguire suit is the classic look. The Tom Holland suit is the more modern look, which actually, I'm not the biggest fan of that suit on its own. It's a little bit too cartoony, a little bit too CGI for me. I love those movies, but I could do with a different suit in the Tom Holland movies. But when it comes to Andrew Garfield and his suit, there is nothing I don't like about it and only things I love about it. I think my favorite detail about this suit is the texture. It just looks like I want to touch it. And maybe that's the issue a lot of people have with this suit, that textured surface. But for me, it just looks so great on screen. It looks so good when he's in action, but also just when he's on the street or in an alleyway walking down it. It just sticks out to me. It has a slightly rougher and tactical feel, but I feel like it adds a sense of realism to the character and enhances the overall costume. It's just so striking to me. And I feel like this suit did what it was supposed to do. It was coming just a decade later that they were revamping and rebooting Spider-Man. You had to make it different. Some people also had an issue with the eyes. But I love the eyes, especially that scene where you get the first real up-close look at it. He's on the side of the building, almost selfie style, and you get this suit in all its glory. This is the best Spider-Man suit, hands down, because it looks like one that can not only take a beating, but also deliver a beating because it has so much emphasis on the muscles of Peter Parker. And I feel like it was an incredible downgrade from the Amazing Spider-Man to Tom Holland's Spider-Man suit. What I was saying back in the 2010s my feelings on this suit and loving it. I feel like people only have those feelings now after No Way Home. And there's much more an appreciation for Andrew Garfield's Amazing Spider-Man 1 and 2 because we've had some time to sit on them. We had time to realize that they really got it right in those movies. And the real travesty is we never got a third one. So that is it, my top 10 superhero suits of all time. I have a few honorable mentions. I was going to say either Thor or Captain America suit from Infinity War. Really, every single suit in that movie looks perfect. They're all so rugged and dark to reflect the feelings and emotions in that movie that really you could pick any single character in Infinity War and that could be the best one. My other honorable mention that's probably going to be controversial is the Black Adam suit. I didn't love that movie. I didn't love the character, but that suit is undeniably good looking. It's skin tight. It's scaly. And maybe I just have a fascination because in my personal life, I wear a lot of black. I just thought the suit looked good. The Rock looked good wearing it. He just didn't really deliver on any other aspect. Also in my honorable mentions, I would put 1998's Blade, which I feel like doesn't get enough credit as being one of the first influential Marvel movies. Wesley Snipes as Blade is so good, but nobody ever mentions him. Also in my honorable mentions, I would have the symbiote suit from Spider-Man 3 in 2007. It's my favorite suit in the comic books and in the video games, and I'm really looking forward to the look of it in the new Spider-Man game coming out this year. Actually, as I plot out my Marvel tattoo, that is on my vision board for the tattoo I want to get. So maybe it's not so much how it looked in the movie, but really what that suit means to me. That's why I had to give it an honorable mention. But that's the list. We'll come back and talk about Mission Impossible, Dead Reckoning Part 1 after this.
What if AI could help your business deliver mission-critical outcomes with speed? With IBM Consulting, your business can design, build, and scale trusted AI using Watson X and modernize the way you work to accelerate real impact. Let's create AI that transforms your business. Learn more at ibm.com/consulting. IBM, let's create.
This is Amy Brown from Four Things with Amy Brown. Today, healthier is happening at CVS Health in more ways than you've ever seen. It's wellness destinations for seniors, including select locations with Oak Street Health and CVS Pharmacy. It's doctors, nurses, pharmacists, and everyone in between offering quality care and support virtually, in person, and on the phone. It's in-home evaluations through Signify Health and meeting mental health needs through Aetna. And those are just a few of the ways that healthier is happening. To see more, visit cvshealth.com/healthierhappenstogether. CVS Pharmacy, Oak Street Health, CVS Specialty, Signify Health, and Aetna are part of CVS Health. Eligibility and services vary by location and individual.
This summer, click into Memorial Day savings at the Home Depot and get after those outdoor projects with some serious cordless power from Ryobi. Tackle more than half an acre of grass with the convenience and gas-like power of the Ryobi 40-volt battery-powered mower. Leaves and debris are no match for the 40-volt power of the Ryobi leaf blower. No cords, no gas, no hassle. Tidy up those flower beds and keep your walkways looking sharp with Ryobi's 40-volt cordless string trimmer. Yard work, done and done. Click into Memorial Day savings happening now at your cordless power source, the Home Depot. Shop now at the Home Depot or homedepot.com. How doers get more done.
About to get into a spoiler-free movie review, let's talk about Mission Impossible, Dead Reckoning Part 1. That title is a mouthful. You could just call it Mission Impossible 7. A couple of things that I have holding me against fully loving this movie going into it. One, historically, I have not loved all of Tom Cruise's action movies. When I look to an action star, I don't really look to Tom Cruise. And it kind of conflicts with the way I feel with him as a person historically. But I try to separate the art from the artist. So I did that going into this movie, and I think I was able to do it. But over the course of these seven films now, I haven't really loved any one of them in particular going back to 1996. That one was probably the best one in my opinion because it was really the only time I cared about a Mission Impossible movie. But it's crazy now that Tom Cruise has been playing Ethan Hunt for over 27 years. And this one is by far some of the best action I have seen in any single Mission Impossible movie, which they had really gone out of my brain space for much of the 2000s. And it really wasn't until Ghost Protocol that they got on my radar again. But I would only watch them when they would come out on streaming. This was my first time in a very long time to go see a Mission Impossible movie in theaters. And I have to say, it is quite the ride. We have come a long way since 1996. So what this movie is about, Ethan Hunt and his team are back and they are trying to track down this dangerous weapon before it gets into the hands of the wrong people. Essentially, they are trying to find this key, this very complex key that in order to unlock something that it goes to, you have to have two different sides of the key. You put them together and then they light up and that is able to unlock something. And through the course of this film, you find out what exactly that is, why all these evil people are trying to get their hands on it, and all the mayhem that goes down in the process. So I got a little bit worried at the beginning of this movie. It had almost a cheesy tone to me. It reminded me more of the Mission Impossible TV show than what I wanted in a big Hollywood adaptation. But by the close of that opening sequence, that all went out the window. And it was a heck of an intro. There was a really big exclamation point that really got me invested in the story early on. And really, the plot line of this entire movie is pretty basic. But in this case, it actually worked. So unlike in a Fast and the Furious franchise movie where it's just a bunch of big, dumb action, I really felt like Dead Reckoning Part 1 had a lot of refined action. It was almost as if Tom Cruise and the director sat down and watched a lot of Christopher Nolan movies. Maybe they watched Dunkirk, Tenet, and went back and watched Inception and thought, we need to take what Christopher Nolan does so well in his movies as far as the action aspect, not really try to make anything that cinematic, but take those action elements and put it into a Mission Impossible movie. So that is why I think this movie just sets itself apart. Because oftentimes when I go see an action movie, I think it's just going to be one of those movies where you turn your brain off, you watch a bunch of things explode and crash into each other, and that's really it. But for some reason, this movie felt a little bit different to me, like there was a lot of intention. And I think that really comes through in this movie, not so much with the plot line, but I think more with the characters, with their story, trying to add a little bit of an emotional element to it. Then when you come in with all of the action, you can really bring it home. And I wouldn't say the cinematography in this movie is very artistic. It almost felt like watching a Nat Geo show. It almost felt like in moments that there was just a GoPro or like a really bare minimum camera attached to like the side of the car or attached to a motorcycle or in the big sequence that we were all waiting for from the trailer whenever Tom Cruise does that jump. It really felt like they were wanting to give you that feeling that you were a part of the action. And I think that's something Tom Cruise is really trying to bring home right now as well. It also had a decent amount of comedy. Now, it wasn't a lot of funny situations or like they were just writing jokes to fit in there. It was just these situations where the action was so intense. They had this little moment of levity. Another thing that really set this movie apart is there was much more of an emphasis on a score than there was just songs on a soundtrack. Unlike in a Fast and the Furious movie where you get a lot of EDM, dance music, late 90s, early 2000s songs, this movie was really intentional on the score. So it added this little bit of texture that made the action just seem a little bit more elegant. At times, when there was maybe a fight scene going on or just Tom Cruise running down an alley, I thought if you didn't have that music behind it, it would seem so cheesy and so unrealistic that if you just zoomed out as like a bystander looking at this situation, they'd be like, why is that guy running down the street so fast? Why are they fighting on a bridge? It would seem so weird, but that score makes all the difference. A couple of questions I had about Tom Cruise after watching this movie. I wonder if he runs in some kind of specialized shoe because this is some of his best running to date. I know he's just become known for that of Tom Cruise running in movies. He runs really well, but he's always in like a full suit whenever he does this running. So I wonder if he has some dress shoes designed by Nike because as a runner myself, I have to be in the right shoes to go for a run. And if ever I try any different shoes that I'm not used to, my feet get all blistered. So I always run in the exact same shoes. So I wonder if he has like some specially designed shoes that look like dress shoes, but are actually running shoes. I was looking, they look like dress shoes to me. So if he doesn't, I give him an A plus for athleticism in this movie. I also wonder if he uses some kind of filter since he has final say on the cut of this movie, because not only in this movie, but also in Top Gun Maverick, he looks very shimmery. He looks very bright. He looks about 10 years younger in some of these shots compared to his co-stars. And he even made a statement last week that he thought about using de-aging for an opening sequence where it flashes back to him way back in the day. I think maybe they were going to even put him in the 80s and use some de-aging to make him look how old he was back in the 80s, but decided against it because he thought that in some aspects, de-aging is good, but sometimes it's not the best. I'm not convinced he doesn't really use that in some of his movies now, because there are some scenes where I was paying attention to it and it kind of looked like there was a Snapchat filter on him. And my third question about Tom Cruise, I wonder, does he feel emotions anymore? Sometimes he feels a little bit robotic to me, and he does action movies well. We see him on the screen and he looks like he belongs there. But I wonder if over the course of his career, being a superstar, being at this level that nobody else is at, if he's lost what it feels like to feel normal human emotions. There are some times he interacts with some of the other actors in this movie that it makes me think, like, is he a robot? Is he okay? Would he be able to do a rom-com in the 2020s? Or is he so far removed from feeling love that he wouldn't know how to do it anymore? Because there are some moments that I know I'm looking at one of the best actors of our lifetime, one of the most bangable Hollywood stars ever, but I wonder if he actually has the capabilities just to feel love, just to have the ability to connect emotionally with some other characters here, because I didn't really feel that from him, and a little bit it kept me from humanizing Ethan Hunt whatsoever, which I don't really think you need that in this movie. You just need to have a character who is larger than life and able to do all these crazy things. So maybe it was just because the character didn't require it. But for me, I didn't see it in him. But one thing Tom Cruise does know is exactly what we want to see. He is kind of like Mr. Beast on YouTube, who is so good at making videos that get millions and millions of views because he gets right to it. He gets right to the action. He puts it in the title. What you see is what you get, and just has this really great pulse on what people want to see on the internet. Tom Cruise is like that with Hollywood. He backs it up with his commitment to stunts, which there was a lot of great stunts in this movie, and there were never really instances where I saw that he used the stunt double. So maybe they used it very specifically if they ended up making the final cut. But especially with that scene that we were all waiting for, the one where he makes that big jump and then parachutes onto the train that we saw in the trailer, that was such a great sequence, but there was also emotion and reasoning leading up to that moment. If you just threw that stunt in a random movie but had no context to it, it would be meaningless, but it really meant a lot to the movie. So it's not like this great scene just comes out of nowhere and just exists for the sake of existing. There was a lot leading up to that moment, and it looked so great on camera. And even though I had already seen it all over the trailer, I still really enjoyed that moment and was probably my favorite thing. It's kind of like the chorus in a song. You know it's coming, but once it gets there, you still want to sing along. That was that scene to me. Tom Cruise is also really good at finding great co-stars, which every single co-star in this movie was great, from Hayley Atwell, who I really know as Agent Carter, S.I. Morales, who I know as Bob from La Bamba. The whole time he was on screen, I just wanted to scream, Richie! Simon Pegg, who has been a part of these movies since 2006, which is surprising to me, mainly because I still just see him as Shaun of the Dead, but he brought a lot of the comedic aspect to this movie. Vanessa Kirby was also really great in this movie. And of course, Ving Rhames. And the movie did pretty well at the box office. It opened on Wednesday of this past week and brought home $80 million in the United States. And what I'm looking at now is $235 million worldwide. So an interesting move for them to open the movie on a Wednesday. I wonder if that was strategically done knowing that an actor strike was coming and that once that hit, Tom Cruise wouldn't be able to promote the movie anymore, which is a pretty interesting wrinkle in a lot of movies coming out in the next 2 weeks, especially as we go into Barbie, Oppenheimer. But overall, it's a pretty big win for Mission Impossible. Probably not going to achieve that same level of status as Top Gun 2 crossing that $1 billion mark. I just think there wasn't that much of a demand for another Mission Impossible movie. And that was much more of an event that this could ever be. It'll probably get in the $700, maybe $800 million mark at best, I would think. But the movie did leave me wanting more. And I went into it knowing it was a part one of two. Part two is scheduled to come out June 28th, 2024, next year. Again, not sure how the strike is going to affect that, which I thought we would be okay. But up until this last week, I didn't realize that if actors go on strike, they also can't promote their projects. So that is really the only reason I could see this being pushed back, maybe just a little bit, because the promotion was so heavy on this movie that if he wasn't able to promote it in the same way, there's no chance they're putting this out. You remember how many times they delayed Top Gun 2? They held on to that movie for like 2 years. And even at 2 hours and 43 minutes, it didn't feel that long to me. Now, I was left wanting more in the sense of I'm ready for part two, but I felt like at 2 hours and 43 minutes, that was all I needed here. It went by really quickly after it got started, a little bit slow in that opening sequence, and then just trying to establish a little bit of story at the start of the movie. But after that, it was pretty consistent nonstop action throughout the entire movie and had one of the best third acts in a blockbuster of this level that I've seen. There were moments that I was literally at the edge of my seat. Very rarely while watching an action movie do I think, are they going to be able to do this? Are they going to be able to pull this off? Is this the end for Ethan Hunt? That is how I felt, and that is the sign of a great action thriller. So for Dead Reckoning Part 1, I give it 4 out of 5 parachutes.
If your business needs a new application, then developers will have to write code. A lot of code. If an application needs to be modernized, then you'll need time, resources, and caffeine. If that sounds daunting, then you need Watson X Code Assistant, AI designed to multiply developer productivity so you can generate code quickly. Let's create a more modern foundation for business with Watson X Code Assistant. Learn more at ibm.com/codeassistant. IBM. Let's create.
This is Amy Brown from Four Things with Amy Brown. Today, healthier is happening at CVS Health in more ways than you've ever seen. It's wellness destinations for seniors, including select locations with Oak Street Health and CVS Pharmacy. It's doctors, nurses, pharmacists, and everyone in between offering quality care and support virtually, in person, and on the phone. It's in-home evaluations through Signify Health and meeting mental health needs through Aetna. And those are just a few of the ways that healthier is happening. To see more, visit cvshealth.com/healthierhappenstogether. CVS Pharmacy, Oak Street Health, CVS Specialty, Signify Health, and Aetna are part of CVS Health. Eligibility and services vary by location and individual.
This summer, click into Memorial Day savings at the Home Depot and get after those outdoor projects with some serious cordless power from Ryobi. Tackle more than half an acre of grass with the convenience and gas-like power of the Ryobi 40-volt battery-powered mower. Leaves and debris are no match for the 40-volt power of the Ryobi leaf blower. No cords, no gas, no hassle. Tidy up those flower beds and keep your walkways looking sharp with Ryobi's 40-volt cordless string trimmer. Yard work, done and done. Click into Memorial Day savings happening now at your cordless power source, the Home Depot. Shop now at the Home Depot or homedepot.com. How doers get more done.
It's time to head down to Movie Mike's Trailer Park.
Come with me and you'll be in a world of pure imagination. Take a look and you'll see. Yes, the trailer is out for Wonka. And if you know me, Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory is a top 10 film for me. Ever since I was a kid, given the movie came out in the 70s, it's before my time, but I just associate it with my childhood. And I've always viewed it as one of the best movies of all time. Gene Wilder is such an amazing actor. And what he did with Willy Wonka, I felt could never be touched. And that is particularly the reason I did not enjoy the Tim Burton version with Johnny Depp as Willy Wonka. It was too weird and kooky. I didn't like his approach to playing Willy Wonka, and I had so many issues with that movie, the soundtrack, the way they interpreted the songs. And where it really just fell apart for me was the look of the Oompa Loompas and just using the same person over and over. I just thought the whole thing was terrible. So when I heard they were making a prequel to the movie, I was hesitant because I didn't want to see them do it again. I didn't want to see somebody try to do what Gene Wilder did. I wanted somebody to come in with a fresh approach and make it completely different. And I thought that focusing on a young Willy Wonka would allow me to be able to enjoy it and not compare it to Gene Wilder playing Willy Wonka. And after getting the first look of this trailer and seeing the way Timothée Chalamet is going to approach Wonka, I think I'm in on this. It felt magical to me. This movie is coming out later this year in December, and I think it's going to be a hit. So before I get into more of my thoughts about Wonka, here's just a little bit of the trailer.
I've spent the past 7 years traveling the world perfecting my craft. You see, I'm something of a magician, inventor, and chocolate maker. So quiet up and listen down. Nope, scratch that, reverse it. So you're the funny little man who's been following me.
I will have you know that I am a perfectly respectable size for an Oompa Loompa.
An Oompa what now?
Allow me to refresh your memory.
Oh, I don't think I want to hear that.
Too late. I've started dancing now. Once we've started, we can't stop.
So let's break down this trailer. What this movie is going to be, it is a prequel to the movie we all know, Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. And it is about a young Willy Wonka played by Timothée Chalamet. By the looks of the trailer, it all happens as he is just getting the idea to not even open a factory, but just open a store. So it's way before he even has his own line of chocolate and way before he even meets the Oompa Loompas. And whenever the first look of Timothée Chalamet came out in the Willy Wonka costume, I thought it looked pretty good. But now seeing the trailer, I think the costume looks perfect. I even really love the look of Hugh Grant as an Oompa Loompa, even though it is CGI. I'm glad they went back to the classic look of the Oompa Loompa and have it looking as close to those original costumes, that original look. I think that is going to be a big part of it. I'm curious to see how they approach the songs in this movie, because you can't really do all the same songs from the original movie because it plays so much into what happens throughout the factory. The only song I could see them incorporating into this movie is Pure Imagination, the one I was singing at the beginning of this segment, because I think it would be kind of a cool approach to show how Willy Wonka got into singing. It's not really addressed in the original movie. He just burst into song and out of nowhere just has all these amazing thoughts like Pure Imagination. But you don't think of him as a songwriter. You don't think of him as the person who created these songs. He is just some guy who is really eccentric and likes making chocolate. I think it would be interesting to dive into the other parts of his brain, and maybe he does come up with songs. Maybe there is some kind of origin story to the musical side of Willy Wonka. To me, it almost feels more like a fairy tale than the original to me, maybe because of this more musical aspect that it has and more being on the origin story of the character rather than the contest and focusing on the kids who come to the factory. It has this kind of Christmas feel to it, and maybe that's just because I'm associating it with the movie coming out in December, that it just has this warm and fuzzy feeling to me that gives me that kind of sense of the first time I watched it as a kid. It's gonna be hard for me not to compare Timothée Chalamet's performance to Gene Wilder. Just by watching this trailer, I think even the first time I watched it all the way through, I felt a little off about it, especially in the beginning part where he makes a reference to a Gene Wilder line that strike that, reverse it. I think out loud, I said to myself, oh no, when I first heard that, because I felt that they were just going to take all the phrases and the mannerisms from the first movie and just implant them into this prequel. And I thought that would be a terrible thing to do because we would just be associating it with the original one. From what I've seen, is almost the halfway point between what Gene Wilder did and what Johnny Depp did. Johnny Depp was so quirky, and I think a lot of that was due to Tim Burton's direction and the feel of his movies that was so weird and very cartoonish. And Gene Wilder just had this really down-to-earth approach to it. And even though the Willy Wonka character in that original movie is a larger-than-life, very out-there character, you still felt he was somewhat grounded in reality and could exist in this real world, unlike the Johnny Depp version. And I think Timothée Chalamet's character in this entire movie will be somewhere in the middle, because it looks like it will have some fantasy aspects to it. You see the people floating after eating the candy in this trailer, and also just the look of the Oompa Loompas in this looks more like a mythical character than it does in the original movie. So I just feel like it has that whimsical Wonka feel that I was looking for, and I just love the look of it more than I was expecting it to. Again, whenever you touch one of my favorite movies of all time, I'm always going to be a little extra critical, because I do think the first movie is a perfect movie, even with that Cheer Up Charlie song in there that I always felt like made the movie drag a little bit. I still think the first one is a perfect movie. And I'm also just not the biggest fan of prequels. It seems like a lazy approach to carrying on a franchise. But I think there was so much mystery behind Willy Wonka that we really had no knowledge of his previous life. And you learned everything throughout the movie and had no backstory whatsoever. I kind of like it that way, because it makes that movie much more of a mystery and makes him so much weirder. Really, the only look you had into him as a person was at the very end of that movie, when you're looking in his office and it's this weird collection of items that are all split in half. That is really the first look you get at Willy Wonka as just the normal Willy Wonka and not the one putting on this tour and being a host. So I think if they can take the energy of that scene and those characteristics and show us how we get to that, I think this is going to be a great movie. Again, this is coming out on December 15th later this year. So if you want to view paradise, simply look around and view it. Anything you want to do it. Want to change the world? There's nothing to it, yeah.
And that was this week's edition of Movie Mike's Trailer Park.
I wasn't really trying to sing there. It's just one of my favorite songs of all time. If I was a gifted singer, that would be the first song I would cover. What a great song. Anyway, that's going to do it for this week's episode of... I just have to say that because I know somebody's going to say in the comments, were you really trying to sing in that episode? No, I was not. I just love Willy Wonka, and I wish I could sing. I wish I could sing. But anyway, that is the episode for this week. But before I go, I got to give my listener shout out of the week. And this week, I'm going over to Twitter, which basically feels like an elephant graveyard at this point. I probably pull it up maybe still once, maybe twice a day, but not a whole lot of activity going on over there. I'm much more of a Threads person now. So if you don't follow me there, I am at Mike Destro on every single form of social media. I will add my Thread account to the episode notes as well. But this week's listener shout out is to Jenna Alexis, who reposted and tagged me in an article that said over 20,000 AMC Stubs members have bought tickets to see both Barbie and Oppenheimer on the same day. And above it in the tweet, she wrote, "We need to know which Mike Destro will be seeing first." So thank you, Jenna, for that tweet, because I am so excited for both of these movies. Going into this weekend of movies, I was probably more excited for Barbie. That is the movie I put in my top 10 anticipated movies of the summer. And Oppenheimer was down there in the honorable mentions. But through the last few weeks of promotion, which they haven't really joint promoted each other, they just both happen to be Warner Brothers movies coming out on the same day. And because of that, and the fact that they are just such opposite movies, it's pink and black next to each other, it has really put them in the minds of everybody. Which are you going to see first? Are you going to see them both together? And the fact that this is a story, I think, is a great thing for movies. The Barbie Oppenheimer double feature is the moment we needed for pop culture. And I really think Barbie has done the best thing with marketing that I've seen in the last few years. other great marketing tactics that come to mind have been whenever Smile had the girl out at the MLB games doing the promotion, just standing there looking maniacal. That is great movie promotion. Barbie has done an amazing job at social media and just letting everybody know that this movie is coming out. And Oppenheimer, on the other hand, hasn't really done a whole lot other than being associated with it and coming out on the same day. So I hope both of these movies succeed. And to answer your question, it was a long way to get around that, but I'm going to see Barbie first on the Friday it comes out. And the next day, I'm going to see Oppenheimer on Saturday in IMAX 70mm, which is the highest quality you can see this movie. Here in Nashville, we just happen to have one of the 20 IMAX theaters that are showing it in 70mm, and that's out of this entire country of the United States. There are only 20 theaters showing it that way, so I'm very lucky to have one right down the road. I actually believe that Christopher Nolan himself paid for this location of Regal to have their IMAX theater fixed to be able to show it in 70 millimeters because this movie is massive on film. The IMAX film prints are 11 miles long and they weigh 600 pounds. And it takes a special room and a special type of projector to show a movie in this high a quality because the room gets all hot. Very few movies are shown like this, and I love seeing movies on real film. It really adds a difference to me. I'm maybe just a bit of a snob when it comes to the quality of movies, and any chance I get to watch a movie being shown on 35mm or 70mm, I'm all in on it. So thanks, Jenna, for that tweet. Thanks to you for listening. Let me know which movie you're going to watch first, or if you're going to watch them both together. Hope you have a great rest of your week, and until next time, go out and watch good movies, and I will talk to you later.
Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, cultural enrichment, and all-inclusive fares. Discover more at Viking.com.
What do the most successful growing businesses have in common? They're working together in Slack. Slack is where work happens, with all your people, data, and information in one AI-powered place. Grow your business in Slack. Visit Slack.com to get started.
Hey, guys. Back at the playground again, huh?
Yep. You know what this playground could use? A wine country.
Heck yeah, and some waves so we could go surfing.
Oh, yeah. Ah, love that.
A redwood forest would be cool.
I'm in.
Ah, ski slopes.
Let's do it.
Can a girl go shopping?
Yeah, baby.
Wait, did we just invent California?
Discover why California is the ultimate playground at visitcalifornia.com.